Is natural history a verb or a noun? How do we practice natural history? Why does it matter that we do, and how might it impact our actions around climate change? What does foster love of the world? We're going to go a little deeper this next hour, and our guests will lead the way. Stay with me for a discussion about hope and compassion and wellness. And welcome, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as always, we thank you for listening and for being a part of our world. And happy anniversary to us. This is a very special show for the Mrs. Green's World team today. It's the 8th anniversary of our very own Mrs. Green's World show in our very own studio. We went live on July 3rd, 8 years ago, so it's been quite a ride. And our team would like to thank every single one of you for being a part of our ever-expanding impact and reach. It's been quite an amazing ride. It's a team effort, and we're still going strong. And a big shout out and thanks to the sponsor of this show and a valued partner of Mrs. Green's World, Tank's Green Stuff. Tank's Green Stuff natural and organic garden and landscape products are made from recycled landscape materials. Their products bring them closer to their ultimate goal of building local industries based in a new sustainable green economy. They believe that there is no better or simpler way to achieve this truly sustainable and impactful business than by being that business and giving jobs to people and making our economy as strong as it can be. It lays the foundation. You can find out more about this truly sustainable and impactful business by visiting tankscreenstuff.com, and I hope you do. So, is natural history a verb or a noun, or have you ever even asked that question? I can assure you, I had not. So please join me in welcoming our guest for this next hour, who will be helping us to answer that question and much more, and provide us with some powerful insights about the importance of our connecting with nature. His name is Dr. Thomas Fleischner. He is the executive director of the Natural History Institute. And the Natural History Institute provides leadership and resources for a revitalized practice of natural history that integrates art, science, and humanities to promote the health and well-being of humans and the rest of the world. And you've got to love that, and it makes me want to go and work there. So, Tom, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here, and happy anniversary.
I know. It's a really important show, and Kelly put it in the show notes up in highlights and make sure you mention that. But it's, you know, we're 12 years old, but we were on terrestrial radio, and then we built our own studio, and we've been independent of that ever since, and it has been quite a ride.
That's very exciting.
It is very exciting. So I want to lay the foundation for our guests. When I heard you speak at the university's Arizona Institute of the Environment almost a year ago, and that's the building we were in, I'm not sure what your purpose in being there was, but you literally had me from hello, and I don't think I've ever said that on the show, using a line from a Tom Cruise movie. And if my memory, it is true, it's like, oh my gosh, I cannot believe what you started with. And if my memory and my notes serve me correctly, it's because your first slide or your first question was, what fosters love of the world? And I just didn't expect it. I was intrigued, especially given what was, you know, soon after the election, which has been a cause of blessed unrest for me, to say it nicely. there's a fair amount of hate and vitriol going around. I think that's a fair assessment. So let's start by talking about, what does foster love of the world? I have many notes and many questions.
Great. Well, thank you for the warm welcome. Well, my assertion, which might be implausible at first blush for some people, is that natural history is what fosters love of the world, and as such is a key element of saving the world and saving ourselves in the process. And I guess the implausibility of that derives from what I would consider a misunderstanding of what natural history really is. A lot of people think of natural history it sort of conjures images of you know, dusty dioramas in museums or whatnot.
But it's not that.
Right. In my conception of natural history, is, well, the definition I have proposed is that it's a practice of intentional, focused attentiveness and receptivity to the more than human world, guided by honesty and accuracy. So, or more simply said, just a practice of paying attention and being open to what one receives. And so that practice opens us up to all sorts of different insights into the world, and it is inherently, I believe, something that fosters hope, that connects us with kind of endless beauty and fascination and exhilaration and examples of how successful organisms can make their place in the world. It makes us, you know, better and better adjusted people. It also, and this is one of the things probably that I think is sorely lacking in these days that you're speaking of, and I agree with your assessment, but the practice of natural history and paying attention outwardly, you might say, is that it promotes humility, and it promotes, in a very, very literal sense, compassion. And compassion is literally feeling with. And the closer attention you pay to other forms of life, the more you're able to feel with what that's like to be them, and then to have a larger than your own limited sense of self. And I think that helps us as people, helps get us out of our sort of petty, well, at times feel like petty concerns. It helps us transcend, you know, real challenges and depressions, anxieties, and so on. And then collectively, it helps make the world a much better and better functioning place. I think it's no surprise to anybody listening to this show that humility is something that's been in all too short of supply, especially at certain upper levels these days.
I mean, I'm speechless to that one. It's like every day I find it incredulous that I can still be surprised at what I hear. And I, believe me, I protect myself very, very strongly against the news, but it seeps in. If I go into somebody's house and I just put NPR on for a short time this morning, and then I realize, no, listen to your meditation tapes, put on music, don't let the poison in. That's how I feel. And be a stand for what you believe in. But it's pretty, for me, a total empath, it's pretty toxic out there. That's why what you said and what I learned from you and was able to put words around for my feelings was so impactful. And that's an honest sharing of what happened to me the night I heard you speak. I said I took copious notes and said, we need to share your message with many. So would that be your definition of what natural history is? Is it the story of nature? And if so, like, what stories? That's a big, bold, the story of nature. What, can you break it down for us a little bit?
Yeah, well, that's a wonderful, great question. The term natural history, it's kind of funny because in English, natural history, it implies that we're only concerned about the past because of the word history. But the original coining of the term was about 2,000 years ago by a Roman writer and philosopher, Pliny the Elder. And in Latin, it was Historia Naturalis. Well, in Latin, as well as in Spanish and many Latin-derived languages, Historia means story. So literally, the term natural history in its initial conception meant the story of nature.
Got it.
And that also, that very explicitly included humans. Historia Naturalis, as a sort of interesting aside, is what that work was not just a single book. It was actually the first attempt in the world at an encyclopedia, a written encyclopedia. There's many, many volumes that tried to assemble everything that was known about everything, basically. So it was very comprehensive, very interdisciplinary. It included things on animals, on plants, on human cultures, on gems and rocks and everything. So your question, what stories do you pay attention to, is a really interesting one. And it's one that everybody that I would consider a naturalist answers in a little bit different way, because we're all sparked by different things in the world around us. I, for example, tend to be, I aspire to be a generalist as a naturalist, but I I definitely get a special spark from birds, and birds kind of grab my attention in a way that, lots of other things don't quite as much. I love looking into the flowers, and I love you know, looking at sandstone layers in the Colorado Plateau, et cetera, et cetera. But birds play a little bit of a separate role, but a close friend of mine might be just the opposite. So there's an infinite number of stories going on at any different in any given place, and so we make choices, consciously or not, about which ones we pay attention to. And in my mind, there's not a single, you know, right or wrong set of choices, but except that to choose that, yes, we're going to pay attention to something around us and not only to ourselves.
So a deeper thought about that, because it almost cracks me up when you said birds, because I have written blogs that say I stop dead in my tracks for the songbird. Always. Uh-huh. If I'm out walking, even in the car, if we're parked, I get out and I say, where is that bird? I need to find where that bird is, because it touches my soul. So that's one observation. But does it matter if it's more contemplative or more conscious? I mean, in terms of the real healing that I believe needs to go on with all of us, is it, mm-hmm. is there a piece of that where you train yourself to be conscious of that, or do you just enjoy the sheer joy? I don't even know if there's an answer to that question, but I was thinking about it because, you know, we have baby quail outside of my window in the studio, and our whole family stops for that. If there's baby quail, we stop, and there's like an excitement and a joy and a laughter, and it's that moment that then you have a smile on your face for another hour because you're thinking about these tiny little perfect creatures scampering about. So I know about the feeling tone, and I guess what I want to ask you is that it? Did I catch that?
I think you definitely did, and that's a great example. And I guess the answer to your question is yes.
that very long question.
You know, you said, do you want to foster sort of a particularly contemplative approach to it, or just sort of revel in the delight of the momentary experience? And I'd say yes and yes. I don't think that's a choice that one has to make. And I think often, and in your example is a good one, they're intertwined, and it would be no point in trying to separate those out. I think, you know, one of the interesting things is, I mean, my background is largely as a scientist, as a ecologist and conservation biologist and longtime teacher. And in the world of science, there's been some subtle and sometimes not so subtle training for biologists that our emotions are what we're supposed to edit out of things. And that we can only perceive the world in a accurate way if we don't, you know, we have to very much guard against letting our emotional responses color our data and the way we record events and so on and so forth. And I completely understand where that comes from and think that there's some importance there, but I also feel like that has gone too far in that direction, and so we have tended to try to divorce our feelings from the importance of our own emotional responses. I think are incredibly paramount, as well as getting the accurate this is what happened, this is where those quail were, this is how many baby quails there were, this was this time of day, etc., etc. So I think in a way the scientific enterprise has done itself and a disservice by kind of trying to artificially sever the scientists' emotions from the subjects that they're studying. And the you know, one of the first times, one of the earlier times that I spoke about this publicly a number of years ago was at an annual conference of the Ecological Society for America, which is essentially the largest gathering internationally of professional ecologists, you know, in the world. And we had a whole series of speakers talking along the lines we're talking about here, and it was really striking afterwards. A number of people came up and talked to me and said, you know, this is why I became an ecologist 30 years ago, and nobody's talked about this since. You know, it's like, so we have to, people have been put in those situations of having to pretend that our emotional responses don't matter, which, when in fact, they're what motivates most people to do good scientific research and so on. So, so that's one piece of this.
And it's,
however, we
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, on the other hand, I think we do need to guard against what psychologists would call projection, which is we sort of foist our own sort of psychological preconceptions onto non-human actors. And so that sometimes leads us to inaccurate understandings of how the world works. So, for example, a lot of people like to say, well, the Earth is in perfect balance. And in fact, from some perspective, that idea of balance is really important, but from some particular kinds of, from the perspectives of ecological science, a lot of systems are inherently out of balance, you know, river systems and things like that, or at least the balance is on a very, very long-term sense. But we like the idea of balance, so we see it wherever we look.
And we certainly notice when it's out of balance.
Yes, right. Far too many examples lately.
Yeah, really, of late. So it's a perfect segue about, do you think that as humans we're hardwired to practice natural history? Is it innate in us and we get disconnected because of the world of what I call gizmos and electronic devices or whatever, urban living? Aren't we, there's my bias shown right there. There it was.
Yeah.
Aren't we hardwired to practice natural history? I mean, you can't make up or learn to have the reaction that I used when I saw the quail, or last week when I was in Petaluma, I saw a fawn the size of a tiny dog, and everybody there went crazy. Of course, it was a conference on climate change, so you had a really captive audience, but that is an innate natural response. Is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, and I think I like the word gizmo for this purpose. But in a very real sense, we are wired. Our brains are wired. Our psyches are wired to do natural history. I mean, I think it's actually not an exaggeration at all to say that humans are born to practice natural history. The very form of our bodies, having two eyes in the front, ears on the side, a certain kind of the way our brains work. Psychologists call neuroplasticity, and the way our brains can retrain themselves and work with attentiveness. Have written that, the very form, the very nature of our human psyche is an artifact of the actual habitat that human consciousness evolved in, the savannas of East Africa. So we our psyches are made to shift, you know, scales of distance and perception, to be listening around for dangers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in fact, I've kind of written that there's never been a moment in the history of the world where there's never been people without natural history, because it's what we do, it's how we survive, it's how we become who we are. And that might be, you know, paying attention to dangers and predators, or it might be paying attention to when particular food plants or food animals are coming into our area or coming ripe or what have you. But it's also just, it's what shapes our consciousness and how we see the world. And I think actually all literature and storytelling derives from this, all aspects of culture, if we go back far enough, all derive from this fundamental practice of who we are. And yet, the contradiction right now that we've been talking about is that right now, at this moment in the history of our species, is a moment when probably the smallest percentage of humans in the world practice natural history ever. And that is highly, highly problematic. And I would assert that that's not coincidental, that this is also a time when we have the greatest rates of various kinds of social dysfunctions and you know, depression, anxiety, you know, violence,
ever, et cetera. And it's a big disconnect. It's lack of connection and community. So, I mean, you're giving me waves of goosebumps because so spot on.
Yeah, well, thank you. So, I think it's not a coincidence that one thing is way up more than it's ever been, right, while the other thing, attentiveness to the world around us, is down more than it's ever been. Because when we're being human animals in the way we were evolved to be, paying attention, shifting scales, like looking close, looking far, et cetera, then that inherently makes us have a sense of proportion of who we are in the world. And it fosters humility, as I said earlier. And it also, as I also said earlier, fosters a sense of connection and compassion with lots of other forms of life. So we don't take them for granted. We don't assume we can, cut a forest down without thinking very carefully about that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And it goes, go ahead, I didn't mean to interrupt. Please go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, in connecting to your gizmo analysis, I think that's huge too, and including in one way that's not quite so obvious, which a close colleague of mine, Laura Sewell, who's an eco-psychologist, has pointed out to me that the very nature of our gizmo culture or our quote unquote devices actually affects the way we perceive the world in a very literal way. So, in other words, not just because we're looking at, whatever garbage on Facebook or whatever, and I'm as guilty as anybody else, but the fact that we're looking at two-dimensional surfaces rather than a three-dimensional world is hugely important. And the fact that these are almost always at the same distance from our eyes is hugely important. And that actually, because of this thing called neuroplasticity, our brain changes so that we actually, the more we do that, we actually come to see less. That's the bad news. The good news is that the very same plasticity allows us to resume a larger vision of the world once we practice it. And natural history is the way that we practice seeing the world more fully. From an actual sort of visual psychology perspective. So that's huge, too.
So what I think is interesting in this whole dialogue is how many questions that I had written down that you've answered, because that's the story. And when I'd never heard you explain that in the presentation you did. And as you were speaking, I was thinking about my own practices, which are always, I have to do a self-check, because I'm so annoyed if someone's on their phone acting like they're paying attention to me and saying, no, I hear you. So I just stop talking now. And then I make sure that I don't do it. But I think about, Tom, I think about the children. If it's literally impacting what we see, think about kids that I see all the time for hours and hours and hours gaming, being inside instead of being outside. So it's impacting the whole generation of kids that are being brought up as the gizmo generation. Maybe we can start a hashtag.
Yeah, right. Well, I think you're absolutely right. And it is deeply troubling, concerning. And I think there's also embedded in there, though, there's some good news and some hope. Which is that by these very same mechanisms, it's actually, I think, pretty easily reversible. If we can just get people,
yes,
kids or adults, whoever, to start paying attention again to something larger than themselves or their screens, their brain adapts very quickly because it's what we were born to do. And so that's a huge, that gives me great hope, actually. And of course, we all need hope where we can find it these days. But I actually find that this fundamentals of the practicing of natural history gives me a lot of hope. I mean, you know, I worked for many years as a conservation biologist and feeling like a lot of the work was sort of resisting damage everywhere. But this whole endeavor of kind of promoting natural history is I think, fundamentally uplifting, actually.
And it is. It's so uplifting. It's like, yes, that's why I was like, you did have me from hello. It's like, this is going to make me feel really good.
Great. Yeah, so that's the good news that's embedded in the bad news.
And we all need hope is right. And I can't actually remember ever talking about the word love other than saying things like love of nature and, you know, in a very cursory sense in quite a while, maybe never. But in your presentation, which in a way I think is almost courageous, and that's very sad, but it is, because people, unless you're going to, you know, a therapeutic session or something, they're not talking about love, maybe couples therapy. And I think you know what I mean. It's not a topic unless you're seeking out a conversation about love. And you said natural history is love. And I believed it and you made me feel it. So what do you mean by that? How is natural history? Natural history is love. What's that all about?
Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you. It is interesting that, you know, as you say, that the addressing the concept of love is not something we do every day. And believe me, in the world of biological sciences or whatever, probably even less so than in the culture
at
large.
That probably doesn't come up a lot.
Right. And so that's just one of the places where I've decided to sort of, you know, plant my flag in the sand and say, look, this is one of the things that we really should be paying attention to.
Well, I love it. No pun intended.
Yeah, right. Well, kind of in the ways we've been talking about, I think natural history, it helps engender passion for the rest of the world. And the more we pay attention to the world around us, whether it's a, you know, lizard, you know, rippling through the dry leaves on the floor, or a new flower that comes out, or you know, black hawk flying over a river course, or whatever it might be, when we pay attention to that, we pretty quickly come to feel something. I think it's embedded within us, and part of my message has simply been that is important, that matters, and that's not something, you know, far from being something that we should, you know, stuff under the rug or pretend doesn't exist or doesn't matter. In fact, that's one of the core issues, and that's really what the world needs. And of course, I mean, one of the discomforts with that word, love, is, you know, well-founded, because it can be, you know, all you have to do is, you know, go down the greeting card aisle or whatever in the grocery store, and you can see that it's used and abused and vague, and can be, you know, one of those words that can say everything and nothing because it's used so much. But it has, but to the contrary, as you've said, it hasn't been used enough, I think, in the context of sort of conservation and addressing social and environmental problems and so on.
And has there been any reaction from your peers or colleagues about it? It is courageous, but I'm just calling it that. It's necessary, because you're right. We want the facts. We want the research. And I say, you know, scientists don't interpret the facts. They just report them. Well, maybe there's a middle road somehow, or another path weighing in on, yeah, we reported these facts. Do you know what the implications are? And here's why you should care. Because of love of the planet, I'm, of course, specifically referring to all the research on climate change and the human connection to that. But it's like there is a real need for scientists to be able to connect with us why that's so important, and not have it just be dry data.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, to the extent that I've gotten feedback explicitly about that, it has been very positive and along the lines of what you've said, or along the lines of the person that I mentioned who said, God, this is why I became an ecologist, and nobody's ever talked about this since. So I think there sometimes there's an almost palpable sense of relief that we're sort of like putting these these topics out in the open air a little bit more. Actually, though, and I think, I mean, I wrote an article many, many years ago, I guess pushing three decades ago for a professional journal that was called Integrating Science and Passion in Conservation Education.
Wow.
Even then was trying to make the case that the facts and the feelings are both important, and it's actually the feelings, while the facts frame our understanding of the world, but it's the feelings that motivate our actions. And if we don't, as conservation biologists, which was the audience I was writing that for, if we ignore that, we're just simply not being effective. We're choosing to disregard what we know about human behavior and then wondering why the actions that we propose are not being adopted. So that's just that's kind of just foolish, actually. So
yeah, and also important. So your presentation also inspired me to do some deeper diving about you, Aldo Leopold. And I didn't know much about him, I admit it. And wow is not quite going to cut it. But he was an inspiring ecologist who many people actually say defined wilderness. So I'm actually going to read two quotes from Aldo, talk about the words of wisdom, and just have you talk about them a little bit, because I think they both tied up a lot, put together in a very neat package, if that's possible, a lot of what you said about connection. So he says, harmony with land is like harmony with a friend. You cannot cherish his right hand and chop off the left. And I just read that and I'm like, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. Think about what that means in this world right now. Harmony with the land. If we had that, everything comes from that. And the other one, equally as profound, and I actually have a third one towards the end of the show. I mean, I'm all over Aldo now.
Great.
We abuse land because we see it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. I mean, who would not get goosebumps reading that? We do see it as something we can just use up. And is it because the Industrial Revolution happened and we didn't really know where our meat came from or if we were going to have meat? I mean, I always have to say, how exactly did we get here in the land of plenty, totally disconnected, like you said, more anxiety, more depression? It's my daughter was reading me yesterday about suicide rates because Kate Spade committed suicide. You know, I mean, someone that you would think has everything in the world. I mean, almost every woman I know has something of Kate Spade or wishes they did. I have one thing. But, I mean, she's joyful. Her designs are, for always me, they were joyful. So what's your reflection on what the wisdom maker Aldo had to say?
Yeah, well, I'm delighted that you discovered his work. I'm sitting here in a room at the Natural History Institute, and his picture is on the wall.
I love it.
Of me. And he was clearly, he's one of my intellectual heroes for sure, and that of many, many people who are conservation scientists and writers as well. So if listeners are not familiar with him, highly recommend Aldo Leopold, and his key book is called The Sand County Almanac. Arguably one of the most influential environmental books of the last century.
Sand
County Almanac.
Okay.
And he and that was a book. It actually was published posthumously. He died in a grass fire on his family's land before the book came out. But he was an incredibly foresightful person. I could go on and on about him for the rest of the show, but he, let's just say that he was a very integrative thinker, and he also, while being a very, very good scientist, he spent an equal amount of energy focused on communication. And in particular, on his writing, he worked very, very carefully on how to get ideas across. So it's no conception that you read his books and it's just, you know, gem after gem. that are, you know, quotable. And so he's, and many people would say that he was sort of the intellectual forefather of the whole field of conservation biology, which didn't get named that for several decades until after his death. But yeah, very, very.
And his words of what he says, I mean, they're timeless. I mean, they really are timeless. It doesn't matter if it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And to me, those quotes tied back to why love fosters love of the world. I mean, they're at the core of it. If we start using things with love and really live in harmony with our friends, then the world seems to right itself in a big, significant way. So I just wanted to share a quick personal story that are connected to the next few questions. But I am like the poster child example of one who actually starts to crave nature. And it's usually when I'm really out of whack, I crave the quiet, the harmony, the peace, the smell of it. And I mean nature separated from noise and crowd. I mean, a real immersion in nature, and I feel my nature deficit disorder coming on, and it's not a good state for me. It's a very agitated state, and I'm tuned in enough to be aware of it. And I guess my first question is, does natural history inspire us and do all of the above? It calms me. It re-energizes me. It helps me with my creativity. Isn't that a result that all of us would want to experience? I mean, that's what it does for me, and it doesn't cost anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, use the word inspire. Inspire literally, or the roots of the word mean, you know, to breathe in. And that's what natural history helps us do. Sometimes in a literal kind of way, we breathe in the world around us, and we certainly take it in through our various senses in different ways. And I, like you, I'm one who prefers or loves to have, you know, as deep immersion as possible. However, I might also add that I think even little tiny immersions, and not necessarily in big deep wilderness, but in a city park, or just even in the trees outside an apartment or whatever. Because sometimes an assertion has been made by some that something like, you know, wilderness or focus on environmental values is kind of socially unjust, because not everyone has equal access to national parks or what have you. I would disagree with that strenuously. I think it's actually that the practice of natural history is sort of the birthright and a fundamental need of everybody, because we all evolved, our ancestors evolved with this, and so it can be fed in a lot of different ways and in different size bites, and so on. And
I could not agree with you more. And I practice mini bites. I really do. I mean, we have saguaros in bloom, and you can walk anywhere. It's free and accessible to everyone to observe saguaros. And we have beautiful parks here. Most cities do. Like Central Park is a very happy place to be in the middle of New York City, and it's free and open to everyone. Because there is that whole, not everybody has the luxury of taking a couple of days off and renting a cabin somewhere and immersing themselves in nature. And I think that's a very, very valid explanation. Just make sure, what I say to myself is that you get your dose and go out and look, get that dose wherever you can find it. And there are opportunities everywhere in every city, on you know, back roads, trees. There are very few places where you can't find it. You know, this may sound weird. My daughter and I, a couple of months ago, we spent 3 hours in a nursery because we were just blown away by all of the things that we were seeing. So we flew by the first break. I made the sign to cut it, but we have to take the second break. I'm like, no, we're not going to interrupt him what you were saying. So everybody, please stay here with me. A 30-second break, and I have some other wonderful questions, and I really hope we get to them. My first one, Tom, that I'd like to start out with, going out in nature, for me, it does give me hope. And I would like to know how. Why does it give me hope to go out in nature? But there's a lot of things to be hopeless about. And how all of that leads to sustainability and what your definition of that is. And I think we're about 30 seconds out. I might have started the break too soon, but I wanted to get ready for another a very strong, you know, third segment, because there are still some questions that I really don't have answered. And I think another question, well, here, I'll leave it with that. But I've got lots more to ask you, and I hope you have lots more to answer. So everybody, please stay here with me.
Hi, it's Meredith, a proud member of the Mrs. Green's World team. We are disruptors for good, passionate game changers working to create a more sustainable, safer, healthier, and socially just planet for all. By creating podcasts like this one, we offer tangible solutions that inspire you to take action. We need your financial support to continue producing content, podcasts, film, and written works that engage, educate, and inspire our global community to fight climate change. Join us today. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click Join the Movement.
And welcome back, everybody. And again, thanks for listening. And hopefully some of you will listen to Meredith and join our movement and become a member. We can use all the help you have to give, because we want to make Mrs. Green's World a household name because of guests like this. And I'm so not kidding. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as I said, we thank you for being a part of it and for joining us. For this hour, we're learning about why it's so important that we intentionally and regularly connect with nature in whatever way we can for our own personal well-being and for that of this great planet of ours. And helping us to understand the importance of that is Dr. Thomas Fleischner, Executive Director of the Natural History Institute. The Natural History Institute provides leadership and resources for a revitalized practice of natural history that integrates science and humanities to promote health and well-being of humans and the rest of the world. And Tom, one of the things we missed, because I skipped the middle break, I'm like, no, we can't take a break. I'll tell a little bit more about you, is that you recently transitioned to faculty emeritus at Prescott College, where you taught in the Interdisciplinary Environmental Studies program for 29 years. In addition to helping coordinate the conservation biology and natural history and ecology emphasis areas, you created courses that linked with many other circular areas, including creative writing, environmental politics, and eco-psychology. And that is what I call an integrated thought process. So again, thank you so much for not just taking the time, but for what you have had to share with us. So can immersion in nature give us hope? How?
Well, yes, is the short answer. I think it does. I think it does almost whether we want it to or not. I think this idea of hope is a really interesting one. I actually burrowed a little bit into a number of writers and what some of their takes on what hope really is and how do we interact with it. But for example, Vaclav Havel, the playwright and former president of the Czech Republic, he had a really interesting thing to say that he contrasted hope with optimism, and he pointed out that hope was not about prognosticating the future, but as he said, that hope is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It's the way that we sort of lean toward sort of the good in the world, you might say. Those are my words, not his. So that's one example. Barbara Kingsolver, you know, talks about hope as a mode of survival, and that it's something that we actually do with our lives, that we that sort of navigate ourselves through difficult passages in our lives. So I think both of those speak to the way that natural history sort of inherently fosters hope, because again, this idea by the very act of paying attention to something beyond ourselves, we are that is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. We're saying it's worth looking beyond myself. I am not the whole be all and end all in the world. I am part of a much larger community, and there's things I can learn from paying attention outside of myself. And so I think in a way that the practice itself is an expression of hope.
That makes so much sense. I mean, it really does. It's not something you're consciously saying, this gives me hope. It's a feeling. It's a feeling.
It's a feeling. And it's, as the Barbara Kingsolver statement makes clear, it's a choice that we make. It isn't just something that might drift down on the winds and land in us if we're lucky. It's like something that we choose to have that orientation of the spirit.
Right.
And what easier way to have that orientation, or to what easier choice to make to go, oh, I think I'm going to walk out on the back porch and see what bird is at the feeder this morning.
Which,
I mean, that example's fresh in my mind because I woke up very early this morning and was troubled by some things from the last day or two. And there I was, and suddenly these small beings were taking me out of myself and reminding me that I'm just part of something much bigger.
And birds are they are the magic. I mean, they really are.
Yeah.
I mean, and we, you know, even if it's, as ridiculous as this may sound, we had a bunch of javelina knock the garbage over the other night. And you should have seen how excited we were. Like, again, jumped to the window. There were some babies. And I'm fortunately, in the natural order of things, not the one that gets selected to clean up the garbage. And so it was a totally joyful experience for me. But even my husband loved it. I mean, we just stopped. It stops you dead in your tracks. And there's something, that feeling tone that, you know, everything is right about the world, even in this urban setting. So how would you... I want to get to the point of where, how do you tie all of this path from natural history to love of the world, leading to hope, and then to sustainability? Can you share a little bit your thoughts with us about sustainability, what you think it is, and why this is all connected to that?
Sure. I mean, sustainability in the last few years has become a word, maybe something like love, where it means something different to a lot of different people. Or it's,
agreed.
It seems it's so... like what's not to love about sustainability? But that said, I think it's a really important thing, and has tied the concept of sustainability has served to tie together a whole lot of different threads of both social and environmental work in a way that I think has been very useful. And I guess when, you know, and that might range from, you know, how is recycling done, or to how are electric grids, you know, working in a particular community, and to how biodiversity is maintained within a particular human community, that sort of thing. But when I think of sustainability, I always come back down. I mean, obviously, the verb that's at the heart of that noun is to sustain, and the Latin root of that term translates essentially as to hold up, or to support, to hold up. So I think in my mind, always when somebody says such and such is sustainable, and sometimes that might be a business, sometimes that might be a government agency,
right,
or whatever, then my question immediately is, what is it that you're trying to sustain? What is it that you're trying to hold up? And I think sometimes the term is used to hold up as in support, not hold up as in like a bank.
Right.
Things that I would admire tremendously, and other times used as a rationale for carry on business as usual. That said, I think natural history and the love of the world that it engenders is completely integrated into any good practice of sustainability, because for one thing, it motivates us to care about sustainability. That attentiveness to the world and that passion that ensues from that is what makes us even care about sustainability in the first place. But beyond that, the practice of natural history provides us with countless examples of how to be sustainable. We want to know, you know, you live in the Tucson area, you know, we want to know how to build desert dwellings. Well, let's look at a cactus wren, or, you know, let's look at a saguaro.
Right.
These are organisms that have figured this out a long time ago. And there's things about, you know, water maintenance, all sorts of things like that we can learn. So I think both as far as how natural history connects to sustainability, it's one, it's sort of the motivating force behind it, and then also it's part of the intellectual material that provides solutions that sustainability is grasping for.
So I think that humans love stories, and you are a wonderful storyteller. And I obviously think you tell great stories because I couldn't wait to have you on the show. It was it's a connection. And I think that there's one thing that gives me hope is more and more with presentations and training, people don't just want the data and the PowerPoint. It's like, connect with me in some way. I think people are starved for that. So Do you think we really do need more stories, especially when it comes to telling stories about natural history? I wanted to share your story with all of my tribe. So do you think we need more stories? And if so, do you have a why for that?
Well, thank you for your kind comment, first of all. And I think stories are a fundamental part of what it means to be a human. That stories are how we have made sense of the world and always have and always will. And but they've happened in different ways. For most of the history of our species, stories were, and let's say, you know, literature, but it's oral literature, you know, stories were told around campfires, around, you know, lodges in a winter cold spell or whatever it might be. But what were those stories about? They were mostly about human interaction with the other presences in the natural world around them. And, or in some cases, forces that were large, but I overcame this mammoth in this such and such a way or what have you. And so do we need stories? Absolutely. The particulars might have changed. It might be I've learned how to overcome cancer in this particular way, but the fundamental practice of storytelling and how it connects to who we are as a species, I think, has never changed. And, you know, there's a quote that I love from a wonderful, well, we were praising Aldo Leopold as a writer, another of my sort of hero writers who I'm lucky enough to know a bit personally is Barry Lopez, who among his many wonderful books was a fable for children and adults, but ostensibly for children, called Crow and Weasel. And a character in that story says, "Sometimes a person needs a story more than food to stay alive."
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
And I always thought that was deeply profound. And so the question is, which stories are useful to us and which stories sort of spiral us down into the muck? And it's not hard to find examples of the latter. And stories that sort of divide us, stories that engender a sense of powerlessness amongst people, but I think natural history and in the large expansive sense that I've been talking about it is something that enables us to have stories that are useful and that are empowering instead of disempowering
and transformative.
Transformative, right?
Yeah. So I have another quote from Aldo. And You need to tell me what he means by this quote. And it's not trick the guest. It's like, but you do admire him, and he's been a great teacher of yours. And when I was reading about some of his more famous quotes, this one jumped out. "To be an ecologist is to live in a world of wounds." What does he mean? What does that mean?
That's interesting that you chose that one. I've actually had that quote pinned above my desk for about 30 years.
I am really nailing it this time.
<It's like laughs> you are.
Connecting with the guest.
You are. I think that is again, quite profound, because what he's getting at is when one is an ecologist, one learns how to pay attention what I'm calling natural history.
Right.
And one learns to pay attention, among other things, to certain types of relationships that perhaps are not the most healthy, or that are not the way things, you know, quote unquote, are supposed to be. Just, you know, an example, one might go out in a prairie that might just look beautiful in an aesthetic sense and is, but then if one's an ecologist and starts scrabbling around in the dirt, they might see that, oh my gosh, you know, 80% of these grasses here are native to Asia, and they've been driving out, their presence here indicates such and such and such and such problems, and they have been actually, their success has been at the cost of, you know, the demise of these other five native grasses, or that's, you know, or what have you. So once we learn how to see and to pay attention, it isn't, one might say, it isn't all pretty. And so that's the world of wounds. And also, and some of it is just not just about human mismanagement, but also, you know, we pay attention and we see, you know, predation can be a pretty grisly thing to witness out in nature, and that is wounds too. But I think he was more talking about attentiveness to sort of the human factor in that.
Because you know,
I once wrote.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I once invoked that quote in a paper and said, but you know, but the good news is that. Because Kiese says to be an ecologist is to live alone in a world of wounds, is actually the full quote. And he and I think that we're not alone, or we don't have to be alone. And so the world of ecology, the world of conservation biology, and certainly the world of natural history is very, it sort of lends itself very naturally to a sense of human community as well. And so we might pay attention to those same things, but we, you know, might be holding hands with our friends while we're doing it, so to speak.
So, such a good answer. I mean, really such a good answer. And I'm sorry I left that word out, because it does have a different meaning. And your other part of it is, we are not alone. And I think that's so important for all of us to remember. And this might be the most important question of the show, and maybe it's been answered through what you have shared, but where does the path to reconnecting with our innate natural history begin for each of us? How do we change our behaviors enough to make this a priority? Oh, I'm so busy. Oh, I can't do this. Oh, how do we fit it in? Do you have some words of wisdom about how to make it happen? And let me just say, from what I heard from you, it doesn't have this big, huge plan to go to the Arctic refuge. It happens with small steps on a regular basis.
Right. Well, if I could borrow some corporate advertising speak, the answer is essentially just do it.
Just do it. I love it. It is perfect. It is.
And like you say, it doesn't, I mean, I think if one feels like, well, I'm going to reconnect with nature in 2 years.
Right, in July of 2019.
Yeah.
Right.
But instead, it's just like, again, making a choice, as we were talking about before. It says, I'm going to pay attention. And it might even just be, you know, starting very small and very simple. Like, maybe when I have to go to work tomorrow morning, I'm going to give an extra minute. And before I put the key in the ignition, I'm going to look around what is happening in my yard. Or I'm going to come back, you know, I'm going to, at the end of the workday, I'm going to allow an extra half an hour and go into the local park or the town square or whatever it might be, and just see what's going on. And it doesn't take much to make a really big difference, is my experience.
I love that answer.
Not just my personal, experience, but I've been immersed in this and, you know, sort of involved in teaching this sort of thing and so on for a long, long time. And I've just seen it happen over and over again. And again, the hopeful part of this is that it's that people are the pump is inherently primed to be receptive.
Right.
And
what a note on which to end. The pump is inherently primed. So thank you, Thomas Fleischner, for being with us. Two great shows coming up on July 5th. Carlos Flores, it's a program called Brag. It's our local show. about an anti-bullying program that is just changing the landscape. And then our July 10th show is Dr. Robin Cloth and Dr. Nisan Marietta, the opioid crisis, an in-depth look. Don't we all know that that needs to be talked about? So make it a great green, intentionally natural history day, everybody. And again, Tom, thank you so much for your contribution to my life.
Thank you so much. It's been great, and thanks for having me.